somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Welcome to this special edition of Clear and Present Danger, where we leave the past and jump into the present for a discussion on free speech and hate speech on social media. And with me to discuss this is none other than Professor David Kaye, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression, as well as a professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. So David, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Jakub, thanks so much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So you have just this week presented a report to the United Nations General Assembly on a human rights approach to online hate speech, which really is a burning topic that is intensely discussed by both governments, social media users, and tech companies. And it's also an issue where opinions on the right approach is divided, to say the least.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Before we delve into the report, I'd just love to talk a little bit about your background. So you're a professor at an American law school promoting human rights norms that have not really been embraced by the legal and political culture in the US, and where the First Amendment, which is, I guess, an article of faith for many Americans, differs substantially from human rights standards in the UN conventions such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, or ICCPR. But what got you into human rights, and how does it feel being an American promoting free speech norms that sometimes clash with those that you were brought up with?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've put the finger on a concern that many people around the world initially had when the Human Rights Council appointed me to this position, right? I mean, how can an American be both a monitor and an advocate for human rights norms around freedom of expression when there's a perception and a reality that human rights discourse and free speech discourse in the United States varies so significantly from the rest of the world? I mean, to answer your first question about how I got into this, I mean, I've been a lawyer and a law professor studying issues principally around international law, but also international humanitarian law and human rights law for many years. I started my career actually working at the U.S. State Department and did a lot of work on Geneva Conventions kinds of issues, both before and after 9/11. And I worked in The Hague for a few years at the U.S. Embassy doing work on all of those kinds of issues around international humanitarian law and international criminal law. And in the context of simply studying those issues, it became clear to me, I mean, a couple of things. One, that restrictions on freedom of expression presented a kind of early warning for harsher repressive measures by governments. I mean, we could see that states often start with restrictions on public debate before they hit onto, you know, the other harsher activities that are repressive in the sense of enforced disappearances, arbitrary detention, all the way to killings. I think there was maybe within the freedom of expression community some questioning or I don't know about concern, but, you know, how is it that an American could do this kind of work? And I've taken the mandate very seriously in the respect that the mandate that I have from the Human Rights Council is to evaluate international human rights law and compliance of governments.
Your job is not to evaluate states on the basis of the First Amendment.
Exactly. Or even on the basis of their national law, you know, from state to state. You know, my role is to evaluate state practices, state law, you know, state policies within the framework of international human rights law. And, you know, as long as I feel like as long as I've taken that approach, and by the way, as a footnote, and I'm sure we'll get into this, some of the interpretation of international human rights law, particularly around hate speech kinds of issues, has moved somewhat in the direction, certainly around incitement, that actually I think is familiar to American lawyers. So I think there's been, to a certain extent, some convergence, but my own role, I've seen it as a very, very much as a, what does human rights law, what does international human rights law say about certain issues? How does it provide guidance to some of the new issues, particularly the online kinds of issues that governments are, and civil society are struggling with around the world? And, you know, when I stray from that, I hope people call me on that.
Okay. I thought it was really interesting that you sense this relationship between initial restrictions on free speech and then a wider crackdown on civil liberties and democracies. That is certainly sort of the red thread that I've discovered through this podcast, where I've tried to cover the history of free speech all the way from ancient Athens, where I would argue you see the two first anti-democratic coups in the history of mankind, like 2,500 years ago, and they exactly started with limiting free speech, intimidating democratic institutions and killing pro-democrats. So I think that's a constant throughout history. And speaking of histories, in this podcast, I've made it sort of to the end of the 18th century. And the 18th century, free speech made huge gains with abolishment of censorship in Scandinavia. You had in America the Virginia Declaration of Rights, the First Amendment. You had in France the French Declaration of the Rights of Man with Articles 10 and 11. But then in the 1790s, there was a great backlash against free speech. You had the Sedition Act in America, you had the terror of the French Revolution, and you had sort of the persecution of seditious writings with a very notorious trial against Tom Paine in England. And I can't help but feel that we're a bit like the 1790s today, too. After huge progress in democracy and free speech for more than a decade, it's been declined if you look at measurements from Freedom House and Reporters Without Borders. So as the UN Special Rapporteur, how do you see the state of free speech and perhaps especially online speech today?
I want to start by saying how brilliant your approach is on this. I think that your focus on the history, Jacob, is so valuable, because I think we often have the tendency to see all sorts of issues as kind of unique to our moment, you know, and, you know, as you say, you can go back, you can go back 2.5 millennia, or you can go back, you know, 2.5 centuries, or you can go back to yesterday, and you see the same kinds of issues that percolate. And so I think the commitment to freedom of expression, which I think is, like, if we look at the thread, there's always been a kind of sense that freedom of expression is essential to, you know, to democratic debate. It's essential to individual, certainly individual self-development, but also to, you know, to individuals having the capacity to develop opinions about public issues that are informed. There's a thread there, and yet it is regularly under attack in periods of insecurity, it could be economic insecurity, because we actually have seen laws develop over time, but certainly over the last several years, in which states will seek to restrict the dissemination of information that might have harmful economic impact on a society. But I think even more than that, and this is something that we've seen particularly in moments of security and public order threats, we see governments seeking to restrict information, the dissemination of information, the ability of individuals to communicate on grounds of protecting national security.
But now we're living in what might be termed the digital age. So we were supposed to be living in an age where it was no longer possible for governments to really restrict our ability to communicate freely, to speak our mind on any topic we wanted. And until 5 or 6 years ago, the tech giants were sort of hailed as these harbingers of global progress and global democracy. But now the mood is very different, and many states have figured out to sort of reverse engineer the internet to serve their own agendas, illiberal agendas. So what's the state of speech from your very important Outlook post in 2019?
Completely. So I'm glad you've focused on this, and also because I didn't really exactly answer your question the first time. I think that that you're exactly right to sort of focus us in on the changes in digital space, because I think that at the same time that we've seen increases in terrorism and the threat of terrorism in a way that we didn't see in the past. We've had that coincide. So that rise of terrorism and insecurity and the public sense of insecurity, that has intersected with the rise of digital space. And that has, I think that's a very interesting intersection. And it's created really in the last, I would say in the last 15 years, but as you say, even more particularly in the last 5 years, a sense that there's something different about the digital age that needs to be addressed for purposes of security and sharing of information and so forth. And so the trend, I guess I would identify one overarching trend that's more social and technological, and then maybe the set of legal trends that we can talk about. But the overall technological and social trend, to my mind, is a move away, you know, beginning 15 years ago from kind of the world of, you know, as we might have called it then, and it seems quaint, you know, the blogosphere, you know, a kind of flat internet, an internet that involved, you know, an infinite number of sites. And infinite is correct. Actually, you can't say infinite number, right? But an infinite site, a set of infinite sites, because they were constantly growing. People were constantly adding blogs to the internet. And because of that, it was very difficult for governments to control that kind of discourse. They didn't have the tools for it at the time, but also it was, you know, it was kind of a whack-a-mole kind of situation where if you had one blog up that was critical of government, you wanted as a government to restrict that kind of criticism, you know, you could go and find a way to that blog and bring it down either by, you know, by its IP address or by identifying the person, but you didn't have really the tools to deal with that in a systematic way. What happened 15 years ago was the development of social media that, you know, brought together so much information into one space. It concentrated and centralized the internet in a way that we didn't see before. And what that meant, again, this is both, you know, technological and it's social, it meant that it was easier on the one hand for governments to go directly to these major places where information was being consumed and say to the intermediaries, that is your Facebooks, your Twitters, your YouTubes, you know, your V contacts in Russia, your WeChats in China, it gave them the opportunity to say to them, we want you to restrict this information. We want you to take down these accounts. And that made it a lot easier to capture more information than the old blogosphere approach. At the same time, it gave corporate actors massive control over public space, massive dominance over the information that people are able to consume. And so it centralized for certain corporate actors also a sense of how to restrict information and give them the technology to do so. So that's like on the technological and social side. And then on the legal side, we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years, a significant increase in a range of laws, some of which are framed as cybersecurity, some are framed as hate speech, some are framed as intelligence law overhaul rules. There's a range of ways that these are framed, but basically we see more and more law that subjects the intermediaries to control and individuals for the content that they post online to harsher penalties than they might have in non-digital space, in analog space.
it's almost like a triple whammy, both like on the technological side, then you have intermediary liability, and then also direct responsibility for user content.
Exactly.
Those are some formidable barriers, even in a digital age. But I want to zero in on the issue of online hate speech, because when you have a democratization of speech that suddenly involves more than 2 billion people on one platform, such as Facebook, you're going to have, let's just call it, a wide variety of opinion. And some of that is, by its very nature, going to be very distasteful to others. And so the issue of hate speech, especially also since polarization has grown in Western democracies, hate speech and complaints of hate speech has become a prominent issue. And governments around the world have resorted to often draconian laws, as you alluded to, in order to curb hate speech. And this is where human rights law, the human rights law that you are tasked with overseeing and promoting and advancing, you might say, I don't know if you agree, but it has a schizophrenic relationship with hate speech. Because on the one hand, the ICCPR provides a strong protection of freedom of expression in Article 19, but then also with some sort of very limited category of exceptions in Article 19. But then it also includes an obligation in Article 20, paragraph 2, to prohibit, that states must prohibit, any advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence. And I think it's fair to say that states around the world disagree profoundly on how to define these limits. You know, you have some that argue that blasphemy constitutes incitement to religious hatred, for instance. So how do you navigate the obligation to both protect and prohibit speech? I mean, you spent considerable time on it in your last report, but also other reports going back to, I think, 2015.
Yeah, so can I do a little shout out to you, Jacob, and encourage your listeners to read your piece from, I think it was 2011.
Yeah, The Sordid Origin of Hate Speech Laws, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great piece, and it really helped. It helped me, and the reason why I want to mention it is because I think it's actually stepping back, I think understanding the origins of the laws that we're seeking to interpret is really important. Your whole approach of thinking about history is really important here, but in particular, the history of the development of the ICCPR's principles and how they're rooted in, well, you know, to say diplomatically, a different conception of a freedom of expression. I think that's important to understanding and interpreting the language that we have today. I mean, my own view is, so my mandate requires me to take human rights law as it exists, and I agree with you. I mean, I think your word schizophrenic is a nice diplomatic way to put it. I mean, I think there are some potential inconsistencies in the law that really require interpretation, and I'm interested in your take on this. My view is that, particularly over the last, I guess, 8 to 10 years, there has been a kind of set of interpretations of both of Article 19 of the ICCPR, but also Article 20, and also Article 4 of the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, that have tried to take some of the ambiguities and the potential open-ended opportunities for governments to restrict speech. These interpretive and expert bodies have tried to take that that law and impose upon it a set of basic human rights values that should inform it. Even when when human rights law says you need to prohibit, as Article 20, paragraph 2 of the covenant says, you need to prohibit by law advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence, that those aren't open-ended restrictions available to states, but they also need to be bound by the rules of Article 19.3, which are principles of legality, necessity, and proportionality, and legitimacy. And I think we've seen, to a certain extent, a kind of convergence around that idea, which isn't totally self-evident from the text itself. when we're looking at you know, quote unquote hate speech, because as your listeners will know, hate speech is not a legal term of art as a matter of conventional international law. So we use that as a shorthand for a whole range of things. But if we're talking about incitement that's rooted in hatred, I think these processes have tried to cabin, to constrain, and maybe not to good effect, because we see a range of new laws that are highly restrictive of speech under the guise of hate speech. But at least the interpretation of human rights law has moved to try to constrain those open-ended restrictions according to fundamental legality and necessity and proportionality principles. I hope that answers a little, or heads in the direction of answering your question.
It does, because as you alluded to, what I explored in my piece was that the drafting history of the ICCPR shows that almost all Western democracies at the time were against including an obligation to prohibit hate speech in a human rights convention, not because they were sort of free speech absolutists, because they certainly weren't, but just because they found it dangerous to include such an obligation because they thought it would provide cover for authoritarian states. And that was sort of affirmed by the fact that it was mostly communist states who were pushing for Article 22. So Eleanor Roosevelt has this great quote where she says this provision is likely to be exploited by totalitarian states for the purpose of rendering the other articles null and void under the guise of protecting religious and national hostilities. But I'm very much pleased to see, I very much agree that the interpretations coming out of the independent UN human rights bodies, perhaps not so much the Human Rights Council consisting of states, tends to be more and more speech protective. I would argue that, very interested in getting your take on it, I think you allude to it in your newest report, that the UN human rights system generally, and perhaps counterintuitively, has become more speech protective since 2011, whereas the European Court of Human Rights offers much more leeway. Even though it deals mostly with democratic states of the Council of Europe, it allows restrictions on blasphemy, Holocaust denial, very broad and vague categories of hate speech, a terrorist apology, intermediary liabilities, broad and sweeping intermediate liabilities. So do you agree that the UN system generally provides a higher threshold of protection? And if so, what explains this differing approach?
Yeah, I mean, I really do agree that that the UN system has treated these issues with a real strong grounding in the idea that freedom of expression is a foundational right, and that we need to be extremely cautious about restrictions essentially swallowing the right. And I think we have to acknowledge that the UN system doesn't operate in the same way as regional systems. I mean, it doesn't face the opportunity, let's say, of adopting binding rules on states in the context of its decisions as the European Court can. So, you know, if it was dealing with more cases in that framework, we might have some different outcomes. But that's, you know, purely hypothetical. And I think its rules are deeply protective of freedom of expression, while at the same time acknowledging in a way that American law doesn't, I think, that and in a way that European law does, that there are other human rights values at stake when we're talking about speech, and that speech, you know, for those of us who want to protect speech, we want to protect speech because we think speech is meaningful. But meaningful speech means, I think, that sometimes it can have harms. And so we need to be very clear about defining what those harms are. And I think that the Human Rights Committee has done a pretty good job at doing that and has given me some of the tools in my own reporting that allow me to be a little bit more specific. I think on the question of European law, I totally agree. I mean, I think, I'm not sure I can answer exactly why there's such variation, but one thing about European law is that it does seem to be, I suppose we could say, all over the map, because we could identify cases that support one position and then cases that support a kind of opposite position, and part of that is, I think, is because you know, there's no equivalent to Article 20 in the European Convention. And European decisions often rely, when we're dealing with what you and I might colloquially call hate speech, they often rely on abusive rights under Article 17, right? And so that gives them, I think, too broad of an opportunity to restrict expression. And they take that on. And then I think layered on top of that is something where there's a very clear divergence between between the international human rights law and European law, and that's margin of appreciation. You know, international human rights law, and the general comment 34 was pretty clear on this, that that there is no margin of appreciation as a matter of international human rights law, that essentially, you know, there's a set of restrictions that are available, they're exceptional for states, and it's up to adjudicators to determine in each case whether a particular restriction meets the requirements of Article 19.3, as an example. Whereas in European law, there's much more willingness, as a matter of legal doctrine, to defer to state evaluations of their own situation. And that principle, I think, which you see in some of the, you know, quote unquote hate speech cases, or, you know, blasphemy cases, or you know, even cases as we saw in the European Court of Justice just a couple of weeks ago, you know, we see this this willingness to look to governments to essentially certify, right, that this is our situation, and then the courts defer to that. I think that's problematic and has led to some of our distinctions between the international and the regional human rights outcomes.
I think it's not only the European Court of Human Rights. It seems to me that both European democracies, notably Germany and France, but also the European Union, has really been very vocal and active in trying to push for speech restrictions online. So pushing Facebook, YouTube, and others to respect European hate speech limits. I'd love to get your take on this, because I think this, in the days of analog, Americans could just lean back and say, you know, okay, so we don't have to care about where the limits on free speech are being drawn in Europe, because it doesn't really affect us. But since European democracies are now pushing Facebook and Twitter and others to adopt content standards that mirror or at least adopt European-inspired hate speech standards, what we see is that these standards are much closer to European standards. So you have sort of a moderation without representation that affects Americans too. It affects everyone, really. Do you agree with that? Or how do you see European democracy's role in this?
Yeah, moderation without representation is absolutely going to be something I'm going to steal from you, Jacob. That is a that I mean, I've been saying something like that in talks recently, in discussing the cases out of the European Union's highest court, the European Court of Justice, you know, related to defamation online. I think that Americans sort of close their ears to what's happening in Europe at their peril, because, you know, the companies operate at scale, and, you know, where large markets might impose restrictions on, you know, on their own content moderation, so on the rules that the companies can apply to content in their, you know, on the platforms, that, you know, that presents for the companies an opportunity, in a way, to say, okay, we're going to adopt rules because, let's say, Germany or the European Union is requiring them. We'll adopt them for our platform globally. You know, it's a lot easier to do that than to adopt rules that are geolocated. It's a lot less expensive for them to do that. It's easier for them to integrate these new rules into their own content standards. And that, over the long term, that's going to have a very serious impact, I think, on how Americans, and not just Americans, but people around the world, view their ability to use the platforms for freedom of expression purposes. And I think there's sort of a follow-on question, which I hope that academics and, you know, and scholars start to look at, and that is, how do the rules that may be adopted, you know, by the companies just on their own initiative, but also the rules that are adopted or imposed on the companies by governments, over time, how does that change our conception of freedom of expression and what values freedom of expression holds for democratic societies? My hypothesis is that since so many people, so many of us, consume information and express ourselves online, that the restrictions that we find there, maybe not for you and me, because, you know, maybe we're already old and set in our ways, but for young, at least I am, I don't want to speak for you, Jacob, but for younger people who are entering a world of discourse and they see these rules, these might become the norms, and they may be more restrictive than we would want them to be. And I think we need to have a real open discussion about what that means for a democratic society going forward.
The most prominent European attempt to rein in hate speech online is the German NetzDG, or Network Enforcement Act, from 2017, entered into force, I think, in January 2018, which you have been critical of. I think you wrote directly to the German government, setting out some concerns, and you also tackle it in your excellent book, Speech Police. Basically, the NetzDG requires tech companies, platforms with more than 2 million users, I think, to remove illegal content within 24 hours or a week, or face fines of up to 50 million euros. So what were your concerns about this? I mean, Germany has a very specific history and specific reasons why it wants to counter hate speech. So why shouldn't they just be allowed to say, we're not going to have, you know, neo-Nazis rally online freely?
Right. I mean, NetzDG is, I would say that it's a good faith response to a real problem. The way NetzDG developed is somewhat interesting in the sense that, you know, if we go back to 2015, and we can remember that that was essentially the moment when, or at least after Angela Merkel adopted this policy of allowing a million refugees to enter Germany, there was an extreme backlash. And that backlash was violence against migrants and those who just looked different. And that was violence on the street. And the government saw that violence was from time to time being encouraged and incited online. And sort of the initial initiative by Heiko Maas, who was then the justice minister, was, you know, let's get the companies in an informal way, like on a voluntary basis, to impose restrictions on incitement. And they reached an arrangement, an informal agreement. It was basically a code of conduct. And after a year, the government saw that, you know, it wasn't happening. You know, the companies really weren't doing what they had promised that they would do. So, you know, moved from the soft law version to kind of a hard law and developed NetzDG, which, as you say, you know, just came into force last year. There are some good things in NetzDG. Let me say that right off the bat. One of the good things is a requirement of greater transparency by the bigger platforms. And I think transparency is essential. Certainly, it's essential for people like you and me to evaluate what's happening online and what's happening with freedom of expression more generally. But it's also essential for users to know, you know, do they want to participate on these platforms based on the way the rules are enforced? So the transparency part is not my point of criticism. My main points of criticism, I guess I would summarize them in two ways. So one is NetzDG makes reference to existing German law, which, as you say, you know, can involve Nazi protest or neo-Nazi protest and Nazi symbols and so forth. Some of those rules are fairly, they're not necessarily controversial within the German context, but they're also fairly clear, you know, things like Nazi paraphernalia and the restrictions on those. But there are some areas of German law that are referenced by NetzDG. They're fairly difficult to pin down. They're hard to identify, to interpret, even for German courts. And so on the one hand, you have kind of the reinforcement of what I see as some areas of German law that are vague and that we might say fail the legality standard by providing too much discretion to government. But the second part of it is that NetzDG says to the companies, you need to adjudicate these kinds of cases. You need to adjudicate what is manifestly unlawful, what is unlawful, and what's legitimate. And to my mind, that is a kind of transfer of authority to non-state actors, to corporate actors that do not have, you know, the public interest. I mean, maybe some of their people have public interest in mind, but that's not a part of their, you know, their economic model. So it's giving them this power that I think belongs in the hands of courts and independent state actors. And at the same time, because of the cost of doing that, it actually, in a kind of paradoxical way, reinforces the power of these private actors. So that's where my concern comes in. Looking back to 2016-17, when these ideas were percolating in Germany, you know, there are a lot of extremely smart and creative German lawyers and academics and practitioners. And I think that it would have been a really unique moment for them to have the opportunity to think through how can we better engage our public processes, our public institutions in the evaluation and the articulation of, let's call it hate speech law, when it comes to the online platforms, rather than simply giving all of this authority to the platforms directly. I think it was a big missed opportunity.
So I have recently, along with a Swiss human rights expert called Joël Fils, finished a draft report on the global spread of the NetzDG, which shows that at least 13 countries have adopted a similar approach to intermediary liability. And the list includes Russia, Venezuela, Honduras, Vietnam, the Philippines, Singapore, Belarus, and Malaysia. And many of these countries actually explicitly refer to the German Act, even though their versions typically go much further and lack the free speech and rule of law protections that are included in the German one and just in German society in general. This, to me at least, is a huge concern that basically you have Europe's most powerful and prominent democracy that has forged, molded a matrix of online censorship that is being used and abused by authoritarian states, and who can then, even if in bad faith, just point and say, listen, if Germany can do this and France is on the way to do the same, why can't we? You know, you're leading the way.
I agree with that entirely. Of course, you know, one response is, and I think your phrase bad faith is important there. These are governments that are going to impose restrictions, or not all of them, but many of them are governments that are going to impose restrictions that fail to meet the, say, legitimacy requirements of international human rights law. They're going to do it regardless. But I do think that, you know, both the existence and the model of NetzDG, together with the European-wide rhetoric around the danger of online speech, has made it easier for some governments to say, look over there at this model. You know, you could see this in the debate that led up to the adoption of the recent law in Singapore, where, you know, they can say, look at the debate in Europe. We share this concern around hateful speech. We share the concern that there could be disinformation on the platforms, and we're going to impose rules that look, they're not any different from what the Germans are imposing. They're no different from what the European Commission is proposing in its in its non-binding fora. So I do have a concern, and I would really have appreciated European leaders discussed these kinds of issues in a robust way, because I don't want to suggest that we're not talking about real problems online, but it would be important for them to talk about these issues on the foundation of the robust protection of freedom of expression and move from there, but to always recognize and to encourage other states to recognize that the restrictions themselves should not be a tool to undermine the essence of the right. And that, I think, is what has happened in many of those places that you identified that are adopting kind of new forms of NetzDG, which, by the way, we see it in the context of hate speech, we see it in the context of disinformation, we see it in the context of right to be forgotten. I mean, Europe is presenting a model to the world, and I think that that European leaders need to be mindful of the impact that their rulemaking and their discourse has on digital rights worldwide.
But what about the platforms themselves? Certainly, if you look at the rhetoric of, say, a company like Twitter in 2012 and today, it's a completely different universe. They used to be like the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party, and now they have a very different tune. Interestingly, Mark Zuckerberg this week gave a speech at Georgetown University where he argued for the importance of free speech, whereas he had just a few months before that invited governments to more closely regulate hate speech. But how do you see the role of the platforms themselves? Do they tend to err on the side of free speech or err on the side of caution in order to please censorious governments? How do you see it? Or is there no red line at all?
You know, your last point is I think pretty accurate. It's not that there's no red line. It's that the companies, so, you know, over time, the companies have adopted, and by the companies, I mean the American companies here, they've adopted increasingly dense rules around things like hate speech, harassment, terrorist content, and so forth. So their rulemaking and their rules have become, much more like governing. You know, they look like governing authorities in many respects. I mean, Facebook even calls its biweekly meeting of content policy people its mini legislative forum. So they're making rules, which I strongly encourage them to do. They are not clear about their enforcement of the rules. There's no equivalent to case law for any of these companies about what they do. Occasionally, when a high profile case kind of percolates up into the media, they'll do something. But for the vast majority of cases, they're being determined both algorithmically and through kind of an opaque content moderation system that is outsourced, in Facebook's case, to 30,000 moderators all over the world. So, my concern is, one, the opacity, two, the fact that there seems to be, again, because of the opacity, it's hard to know for sure, but there seems to be a very significant inconsistency among sort of the jurisdictions, the markets where the platforms are operating. And so, on the one hand, there's this effort to get things right. On the other hand, and I think this came through in Mark Zuckerberg's speech, which I did a little Twitter thread on it. I mean, I really didn't like it. I wanted to, but I did.
No, I saw that. I had a much more positive take on it. But please elaborate your criticism.
I mean, my criticism was that it's a global platform. And to speak the language of First Amendment for a global platform is inappropriate. It doesn't resonate with people around the world that have a different set of standards for thinking about freedom of expression. And, I also think that he didn't account for, some of the very significant criticisms of Facebook around, its kind of power over public space in many parts of the world, and its inability to articulate how it's enforcing standards in jurisdictions around the world. So, I mean, that's where my focus sort of hit on that particular speech. I think that there's a significant amount of room for improvement. There's and maybe I should just sort of close this particular point by saying that I do think there'd be a lot of value to the companies rooting their standards more in human rights law rather than what they do now, which is, basically their standards are through their terms of service. So they have a kind of contractual basis. You can have access to our platform as long as you adhere to these rules, which are our rules. If they had human rights standards, I think they would be easier to articulate to people. They'd certainly be, they'd have a better basis to articulate their decisions to governments. They're not doing that. And that, I think that's unfortunate. And I think, you know, Zuckerberg missed an opportunity to kind of re-articulate. And I just want to footnote here, the company as a whole has been sort of talking a little bit more about human rights standards. So it was somewhat surprising to me that he didn't go down that path in his speech itself.
I actually appreciated that he stood up for free speech as an important principle and said that it's so important that we'll also have to suffer opinions that we really disagree with. I also thought he made some good historical points showing how free speech had actually been on the side of progressive movements and so on. But I want to get back to your point. How realistic is it that, say, Facebook and Twitter and others base their moderation on human rights standards? So when I look at your report, that is basically your suggestion. And you and the Human Rights Committee have developed some pretty robust guidelines to interpreting the restrictions on free speech when it comes to an issue like hate speech. So six elements that has to be included that are very sort of context specific also. How can a platform like Facebook, with more than 2 billion people, realistically base themselves on such an interpretation when they clearly have a financial interest in just moderating on scale and using basically automated moderation through machine learning?
The question of human rights standards is, I think the scale point that you're alluding to is certainly kind of the backdrop to this discussion. My feeling has been that the companies have for too long, I mean, essentially said, we are so big, we can't do that kind of fine evaluation of standards that might be required by human rights law. And my response to that is, you can't use your success as a reason to avoid standards. Clearly, human rights law standards, which, look, for companies would be a matter of, you know, recognizing their responsibilities consistent with the UN guiding principles on business and human rights. It's not, I'm not saying that the companies are governments that need to have every single indicia of government authority and government role. I'm saying that human rights standards can provide a framework for the companies to evaluate whether their rules, their products are consistent with human rights standards, with the human rights of their users, the human rights of the public, and their impact on public institutions. And can serve as a framework for how they think about their responsibility to their users when governments make requests and demands of them. I think that the scale issues, companies will need to deal with that. I think they need to figure out better ways to get access to local communities. They need to have better ways to evaluate context, which is, you know, in the Rabat plan of action, identifies, you know, a series of factors, certainly for criminal incitement, but I think that are valuable for all sorts of speech, hate speech kinds of regulation questions. You know, the companies need to figure out how to integrate that into their own rulemaking and their enforcement. My sense is they're doing a very poor job of that.
David, thank you so much for taking the time. I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope we can stay in touch and continue it in different fora as well.
Jacob, thank you so much. I wish we had another hour.
Yeah, me too.
I think I feel like I need to start my own podcast so I can turn the table and ask you these questions as well. Because yeah. I really have valued your writing and work on these issues over the last several years. So thanks to you too.